The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Because of a legal snafu, today the role of Eric will be played by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
And the role of Sonia Sotomayor will be played by the late Minnie Pearl. And now your host,
Mr. Lumpy Jinglepants.
Take it away, Lumpy.
Hey, folks, this is Eric Metaxas. I always love to start the program confused. Whatever Todd just said, I'm sure there's some truth in it. There's some truth in every lie, by definition. But I have to tell you that... I don't know what he's talking about. Here's the good news. This is the show about everything, which means I get to talk to all kinds of fascinating guests about all kinds of fascinating subjects. And today, of all days, finally, I'm able to speak with the great Mary Eberstadt, whose works I have read, whose essays I have read. What finally prompted us to connect was an essay that she has in First Things Magazine. You all know that I'm a fan of First Things Magazine and Rusty Reno, its editor, and have been for many years, not least because they deigned to publish a poem of mine in 1999. But anything you read in there is probably worth reading, but anything by Mary Eberstadt is really worth reading, and I'm just dying to get to speak with her. So first of all, I have to shut up and say, Mary Eberstadt, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Thanks so much, Eric. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
Well, I have to tell you, you're one of those people that I wonder why it is that we haven't spoken on this program yet or spoken at Socrates in the City, because I have just loved your work. And so we have to at least begin remedying that right now. We're already remedying that. You've done so much. Before we get into your most recent article in First Things, just a little bit on your background. First of all, what city are you in?
In the Washington, D.C. area.
Okay. I knew that. Your husband is also an academic.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Nicholas.
Well, you started life, like, I guess, at Cornell. No, you weren't born at Cornell. Where do you originally hail from?
I grew up in a series of small towns all across upstate New York, so I'm a rural country girl by background, but I've counterbalanced it by living in big cities ever since leaving college.
I was going to say, at this point, you're more urbane and metropolitan than anyone could hope to be. The articles that you write, I love them because you have your finger on the pulse of what's happening, with regard to the secularization of American and Western culture. It's far worse in the rest of the West than it is in America, but it's getting very bad here. And your article at First Things, I mean, it really kind of sums up a lot of your work. So let's start there. First of all, I don't have the title of the article in front of me, but the new article in First Things.
It's in the January issue, and it's called The Zealous Faith of Secularism.
Okay. It's interesting. One of the things that I have talked about, and I haven't heard many people talk about, and we can maybe start here, is that it strikes me that when the founders in the original documents talked about the separation of church and state. The idea, of course, was to keep the state out of the lives of people who want to worship, and not only worship, but practice their faith as they see fit. And so that the establishment of any particular religion, quote unquote, is unconstitutional, fundamentally un-American. It seems to me that there is a secular religion, or it has seemed to me that there's a secular religion, but it doesn't call itself a religion. It kind of hides behind this fake idea that religions are only those things, Christianity, Islam, so on and so forth. So if we're secular, we're somehow not only anti-religion, but non-religious. And in fact, what you say in this article and what I've been thinking about is that that is not the case, that there is a kind of secular religion, and it has become the de facto state religion. We are, in fact, doing what the founders said we cannot do. We're establishing a religion in our day. So let's just start there.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right, Eric. The state is more and more throwing its weight on the side of this new secular religion. But in order to see that, first of all, we have to dispose of the dominant paradigm, which has been around for a long time now. And that's the paradigm according to which there are religious believers, people who go to church, mosque, synagogue, and then more and more there are the unbelievers, secular people, people who think themselves enlightened, people who think that religion is a thing of the past. Now, this is the dominant paradigm. This is what the new atheists were talking about, and this is the model that's been unconsciously absorbed by many people. The point that I'm trying to make is that that model doesn't describe reality. It doesn't describe the way human beings operate. Human beings need some kind of transcendent horizon. They need to attach themselves to deeper things or feel as if they've done this. And so what has happened, I argue, is that the sexual revolution beginning in the 1960s has actually given rise to a full-blown alternative secular faith. And in the article, I get into examples of where we see this. I'll tell you, Eric, where we're going to see it imminently is in these women's marches that are taking place this weekend, a year after the original women's march. Now, you know and I know what they call the hats that they wear for these marches. But the point is that these marches are not about traditional political things. They're not about jobs. They're not about economics and foreign policy. They are exactly about trying to protect the prerogatives of the sexual revolution. And what's absolutely central to these marches is abortion and keeping abortion on demand as the law of the land. If you look at the speakers who are being brought into these marches, again, these are not wide-ranging political figures. No, these are people overwhelmingly on the side of the proposition that abortion is the most important issue in America. I argue that this is coming out of this new secularist faith.
I think that it's interesting because what I like about what you do, I try to do the same thing, is to invite people on the other side of these issues to listen in and to see that we have a lot in common. And one of the things that we ought to have in common, true liberals would say that we should have tolerance of other ideas, including the ideas that you and I have, that perhaps abortion on demand is not good. Perhaps the current feminist movement hurts many women and is not speaking for many women. I think of most of the women I know would not be welcome at the Women's March, the irony of ironies. Why? Because it has nothing to do with being a woman. It has to do with a certain ideology, as you call it. It's a kind of secular religion. The irony there is tremendous. But what you seem to hold out hope for, and in your recent book that you have written, that there are good people on the other side who might see what we see about this intolerance toward a certain worldview.
Well, the dominant ideology in so many places, including, of course, academia, of course, Hollywood and other influential venues, is this secularist faith. And part of the reason I try to reach out about this and reach across the aisle is that I think many people in those precincts have never been exposed to an alternative way of thinking. So what I'm trying to do is put the proposition before them, look, we all believe something. We all believe in things beyond ourselves. You have to choose what it is you're faithful to. Because I do think that if people can see this as a competition of ideas, we might be able to pull some over to a different side than a side they know exists.
Well, it's interesting. You talked about in the speech you gave at First Things, I don't know when that was, it couldn't be too long ago, but you talked about the harm that is done to the poor, to the people that those on the left would theoretically care about helping. And that when you have organizations, whether it's the ACLU or others, attacking let's say, pregnancy care centers and involving them in litigation, who is hurt? The women that pregnancy care centers help. It's bizarre. We're going to go to a break. When I come back, folks, happily, I am talking to Mary Eberstadt. We're going to be right back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. I want to continue the conversation with her as soon as possible. And the only thing I can do along those lines is to shut up and say, Mary, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Eric.
Listen, there's just so much that you say that I resonate with. I was just saying, I was really parroting what you said in your talk at First Things. I think people can see it on C-SPAN, and I put it on Twitter and Facebook. But you talk about how the irony is that there are women and others being hurt by the angry, divisive tactics of some on the progressive side, that they're unwittingly harming the very people that they say they want to help.
Yes, I think this is one of the biggest stories of our time, Eric, and I don't think most people understand it as such, but they need to. So let me just list tick off a couple of ways in which progressivism, despite its promises, hurts the poor. You have the attacks on Christian charities that are undertaken, again, mainly by people in possession of this secularist faith, according to which religion is bad. Well, for example, Catholic Charities adoption wing in Boston was shut down by nonstop litigation. And the result was really not a catastrophe, but certainly the result was to make it harder to put orphans in loving homes. And this was widely acknowledged at the time. No secularist or state organizations grew up that had the same supply lines and the same knowledge of where the children were, where the would-want-to-be parents were, et cetera. So that was a clear-cut case of where an ideological attack on a religious institution hurt some very needy people by depriving them of opportunities that the adoption agency could have found. And that's just one example. There are many more. In California, the concerted attempt to shut down emergency pregnancy centers, of all things, places where women can go and get free sonograms and counseling and diapers and material support in other forms. This, again, is a clear-cut, heartless ideological attack on religious institutions. Now, why would anybody want to do that? Why would anybody want to hurt poor people? The answer is they don't think they're hurting poor people, or more precisely, they think poor people are just so much collateral damage that can be accumulated in the name of the sexual revolution. Again, that's what this is all about. A lot of us would rather talk about other things, but it's the sexual revolution and the protection of that revolution that has given rise to these otherwise bizarre experiences where religious organizations that are trying to do charitable work are impeded by secularists. It's a perverse spectacle.
There's so much here to talk about, namely because this is kind of the story of the last 50 years. Let's start kind of at that beginning. You wrote a book a couple of years ago, 2012, I think, Adam and Eve After the Pill. You talk about how the birth control pill, when it was invented in 1961, I guess, changed everything. Others have talked about that, but you talk about it particularly eloquently, and it feeds right into this new worldview, which is really a secular religion that's being established in the United States of America. Talk a little bit about that book and that idea.
Well, the dominant narrative about the sexual revolution and the birth control pill is a positive one. And there is no doubt, Eric, that mass contraception has made it easier for women to be in the workplace. It's changed a lot of things about our world. My question is, was the material prosperity worth it? Because what I tried to do in that book was to show the other side of the legacy of the sexual revolution, the rise in broken homes, the social science demonstrating what we know about broken homes and the problems of the children in those homes, et cetera. Now, the point of going into this record isn't to make anybody feel guilty in particular. In fact, part of my argument in that book and elsewhere is that we are all swimming in the same sea. I mean, we're all trying to figure out what to do about this 50-plus years after the revolution. But the point of it is to say that there's a lot of human damage out there that is not being acknowledged, that's being papered over with happy talk. And the problem really is this. When all of this got started, when the world changed in the 1960s, people could honestly claim that they thought they were improving things, and they thought these changes would be for the better.
Correct.
They had good faith. 50-plus years into this experiment, we can't pretend we don't know these things. This is something that Leo Tolstoy said once, reporting on what he saw in a slaughterhouse. He said, we can't pretend we don't know these things. And I just keep coming back to that thought, not in that context, but that thought. We can't pretend we don't know the real record of the sexual revolution.
I mean, you could go in any direction because there are so many things that we now know about the downside of the sexual revolution, which we can honestly say, just as you said, that we didn't know. In the 70s, people are getting divorced and you hear the cliches over and over and over again. It's not about the time you spend with your kids. It's about quality time. So if there's strife in the marriage, get out of the marriage. And then if you spend great time on the weekends with the kids, that'll be even better than staying in the marriage. And so divorce proliferates. And then all these years later, we can see, hey, you know what? That was not a good idea. On balance, that was a very bad idea. The same thing with abortion. How many women's lives have been ruined and they have nowhere to go with their stories of pain? This is what outrages me. My own wife runs a crisis pregnancy center, as they're sometimes called, here in New York City. And you hear the stories of women who've had abortions. They have been broken by it. They're sorry. They don't know what to do. Some of them don't have any kind of Christian faith, so they don't even know about the idea that God would want to forgive them. So they're walking around with this pain, and we live in a culture that says, shut up. We don't want to hear your story. All abortion is good, and anything that buys into the narrative that it might not be good, we don't want to hear it. Everywhere you look, we have more and more evidence of pain as a result of the sexual revolution. Where do you see any hope outside of your books and your speaking that we might be able to do something about this?
Well, I am an optimist about this, Eric, because if you look at the people who are younger, even though you see a rise in the so-called nuns, N-O-N-E-S, the people who don't attend church or regard themselves as part of a denomination, even as those numbers increase, for perfectly understandable reasons, because many of them were never churched in the first place, because many people are coming from broken homes, even if you look at those numbers that a lot of religious people find very depressing, what you see in the people who come into the churches is that they are looking for the alternative. The sexual revolution itself is driving people into church now. And I find that very promising. If you look, for example, at the Catholic Church, the most orthodox, small o orthodox, institutions within the church are the ones that are prospering. The Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., to name one example, those are the guys who dress all in white robes and study Thomas Aquinas, and otherwise are, very faithful and orthodox to the tradition. they have to turn people away every year because they have so many people who want to join.
Again, yeah, that was Father Greschel's denomination. Is that right?
No, he was something else, but it's, you know, of similar mind.
Okay.
Orthodox and faithful and disciplined. So what's happening is that people, there's so much damage out there. Things are so broken that people who are honestly looking for alternatives are finding it again in religion. And of course, there's a great irony here because in the 1960s, of course, it was the sexual liberationists who were supposed to be the counterculture, right? They were the cool guys, and they were the guys everybody sort of envied and wanted to join up with because of their cachet. Now the polls are exactly reversed. The real counterculture is with the religious faithful, and I find that a very interesting sort of paradox.
Yeah, well, there's no question they took control of all the institutions, certainly the media and academia. And here we are. Now, those of us who think the way we do, we're the counterculture, and we'll be right back. Folks, I have the joy of speaking with Mary Eberstadt. This is the Eric Metaxas Show, our website, metaxastalk.com. Tell your friends. We'll be right back. Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt, and the first question I have in this segment for Mary Eberstadt is, Mary, how do you pronounce your last name?
Eberstadt.
Oh, I got it right. As a German, I want to say Eberstadt, but that's a little too much. Eberstadt. Okay, you've written so many books. The most recent of which is How the West Really Lost God: A New Theory of Secularization. Actually, I take that back. You have a new book out called It's Dangerous to Believe: Religious Freedom and Its Enemies. Same topic. Before that, you wrote Adam and Eve After the Pill. All kinds of great stuff. My friend Terry Mattingly, I don't know if you know Terry Mattingly, but he has a blog called Get Religion. And he, for years, has been writing about the dissonance between how the mainstream media doesn't understand people of faith. And he always talks about what he calls sex rev, meaning the new orthodoxy. It's all around the issue of the sexual revolution. You can look elsewhere. You can look at all kinds of stuff. But just as you have figured out, it boils down to this one thing. The sexual revolution is the new narrative. It's the new religion. And of course, as we've been saying, women, ironically, who were promised nirvana and utopia have been hurt the most by this. But even they seem unwilling to talk about that, or the ones who want to talk about it like you aren't allowed to speak. I think of so many women who've been pressured into being sexualized, into taking the pill. I have a dear friend who was at Yale in 1971, and she tells the story of how women were practically forced to visit the Yale, doctors and get the pills, because here you are. Now we're shipping in the women so that all the men at Yale can now have free sex. And she describes it. You've never heard it described this way in the mainstream media. How many women have been traumatized and pushed along and hurt by this? That, to me, it's one of the stories of our time that's simply not being told.
Well, it's so interesting that it was the backdrop to all of the Harvey Weinstein, et cetera, scandals.
Yeah.
Don't you think, Eric? Because
no question.
You know, just when it looked like the world could never be convinced that the sexual revolution had done some damage, along came the scandals. And lo and behold, now how are they linked to the revolution? I know some people would say, well, there have always been predatory men, and there have always been men in positions of power, and what do you expect? But that kind of predation on that scale that we see in Hollywood, that we see in left of center journalism of all places. That kind of predation is premised on something. It's premised on the idea that enough women are always sexually available that if you just, you know, hit on every single one, you're going to get what you want pretty soon. That's the idea. And that's a sexual revolution idea. If there hadn't been the revolution, there couldn't have been these scandals on this scale.
Well, so also,
you would think that, that people would understand that was some kind of tangible proof of the damage out there. And that's just one silo of it, too.
Well, there's an article that just came out in National Review about how this idea that we have that it's all about consent, as though you can build a morality, sexual morality, on this idea of consent, how that doesn't work. It's not that simple, because what women discover after they've been used and abused that, you know, even though I'm told that I'm just a bunch of cells and that I shouldn't feel anything, I shouldn't feel broken any more than the cad who's abused me, I do feel broken. I do feel sad. I do feel something is missing. I'm not supposed to feel like this because I'm supposed to be just like a man, just like a callow man who's done this to me. It's interesting that those women don't have a voice. And I think that the Me Too movement has begun to give some of them a voice and show the dark side of the sexual revolution, as you put it.
Yes, what you're expressing so well, Eric, is some of the confusion out there. And that's why I think we're all called upon to have a lot of empathy, which is part of why I try to talk to the other side. Because a lot of people have been damaged without their permission at all. They believed in the lies of the sexual revolution. And the result is, as you're describing, a lot of hurt women who are baffled about romance and love. And there's another aspect to this that we're seeing that comes later. The fastest growing field in sociology right now, horribly enough, is something called loneliness studies. Mm. If you go Googling around, you can find them in all over Western Europe, in every single country. You can find them in the United States. Now, why is there so much interest in loneliness? The answer is because so many people are living alone, including into old age. This, too, is fallout of the revolution.
Right.
The way it has shattered not just the family, but people, you know, sundering people from any kind of human community. We are not meant to live like that. We're animals. We're social animals. And when we see animals in isolation, like an elephant at the circus or, you know, something like that, some people get upset and say, hey, they're meant to live in community. But the funny thing is, progressives can see that so clearly in the case of any animal but themselves.
We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. It's the Eric Metaxas Show, metaxastalk.com, the website. And now, of course, a little Casey and the Sunshine Band. Folks, this is the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. We're talking about the sexual revolution, the downside of the sexual revolution. And I guess my question, Mary, is do you think that, I think that most women, let's say, it's mostly women since they're being hurt the most by the sexual revolution, even though they're being told the opposite, most women aren't even aware, unless they are serious Christians or serious Orthodox Jews or Muslims, they're not even aware that they don't have to have sex. They feel pressured into having sex as though if they want to be even possibly on the road to marriage. There is no choice but to put themselves out there. And if somebody can only tell them, excuse me, you don't need to do that. You will do better if you don't have sex. I think it would be incredibly freeing for most women to not have to believe this lie that this is good for them, because it's not.
Oh, of course you're right. And of course there are other things going on in the background here, which are also attributable to the revolution and also not good. So ask yourself, why do so many women seem not to get it, not to have any understanding of the difference between the sexes or of what's in their own best interest? I think part of the reason, Eric, is that the shrinking of the family has deprived many women of brothers, fathers. Sexual revolution has deprived, you know, many of their biological male relatives.
Wow.
But both by breaking up the family and by shrinking it. So a lot of women don't have a protective reality check. They know the male world only as a world of predators, not as one of protectors. I think
I've never heard anyone say that. I've never heard anyone say that. That's fantastic that you've seen that, because I think you're absolutely right. I think that is a big piece of this puzzle. I really do.
And the flip side obtains too. A lot of men don't know anything about women, or worse, they think they know because they've watched so much pornography that they think that's what women are about. So by shrinking our natural communities of the family, the revolution has also made us know less about each other and, you know, shattered the idea that the Christian idea that we're brothers and sisters. And I think at the deepest level, that's really what's going on here. The confusion is emanating from this really weird fact that even though men and women in one sense are more intimate than ever before in human history, in another sense, they know each other less and less.
I've never heard anyone say that. That's profound and strikes me vitally, vitally important. I've talked about this a little bit. I haven't seen what you just said until now, but I've talked about the idea that male strength has been repudiated as though male strength is inevitably abusive toward those who are weaker, namely women. And so therefore, men have to be emasculated, have to have less strength. Women have to be empowered, which is a lie from the pit of hell, because the idea is that male strength is intended by God to be used for women. There's no question about it. When I saw Paul Sorvino using four-letter words because of his anger at how his daughter had been treated by Harvey Weinstein, I thought, if every Harvey Weinstein knew that there's a man like that and a man like Eric Metaxas who may well kill them with his bare hands if he treats his daughter anything approaching the way Mira Sorvino was treated, I think the Harvey Weinsteins of the world would say, you know what, I don't want to be killed by Paul Sorvino or a hot-headed Eric Metaxas. I don't want them to try to kill me because what I did to their daughter, so maybe I won't do that to their daughter. You never hear about that in the popular culture. Male strength is always portrayed as abusive of women. That, to me, is one of the big lies that has contributed to this.
Absolutely. And on a parallel track, it's also why there's less marriage. It's why the old term shotgun wedding doesn't exist anymore. But if you think about what it symbolized exactly that. A protective father or brothers or cousins making sure that a young man did the right thing and married that girl, right? Well, once again, what we're seeing is the disappearance in individual lives of these protective figures. And I guess I really started thinking about that when over and over reading about the Harvey Weinstein, et cetera, scandals, I kept thinking, how could these men do this? Don't they have daughters? Don't they have sisters? And suddenly, Eric, it occurred to me, you know what? In the world we live in now, a lot of them don't. They
you know
don't.
What? That's you're exactly right. You're exactly right. Because I have a daughter, because I'm married, because I have a mother that I have a good relationship with, it changes my view of all of these things. It makes me so angry at any man who would behave like a pig, whether it's Bill Clinton or I don't care who it is, that you think that That cannot fly. And I think to myself that we haven't gone back far enough to expose, let's say, you know, the sainted pseudo-Catholic John F. Kennedy Jr., who is bringing prostitutes into the White House, that this is the kind of thing that it's the antithesis of respect for women. And it's been everywhere, and it's been given a pass. I do think that there's hope in the sense that we're beginning to talk about this.
I think there's lots of hope, Eric. In the piece in First Things, I talk at the end about this true story that hit me like a thunderbolt. A young woman was making a documentary, and she looked me up, and she asked me to meet with her. And it was a documentary to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae this year, which is the papal teaching against birth control that was so controversial. And her life story was staggering. She had been born deliberately with her mother not telling her who her father was. Her father was a radical, mother was a radical feminist. And she had been brought up to fear and hate men. Somehow, she fell in with a very secular guy from Scandinavia.
Forgive me, Mary. I have to cut you off. We're gonna continue this. We'll be right back, folks. Do not go away. This is important. We'll be right back with Mary Eberstadt. You got the notion. Folks, it's the Eric from Texas Show. Boogie nights are always the best in town. Please make a note of that. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. Mary, I cut you off. You were talking about somebody that you talked to who'd been raised, not to know who her father was, raised to hate men. And then what happened?
And then she met someone just as secular as she was, a young man from Scandinavia. And this story is so incredible to me, Eric, because these two people met and fell in love, and both of them wanted to be serious people, and little by little they started questioning where they came from, and where they came from was, of course, the church of the new secularism. And little by little they started reading and meeting with others. Long story short, they're now both Christian converts who are ardent about their faith and very knowing about what they left behind and why. And I think this gets us to an important point, which is that people in the churches, people who are taught that we're all sinners, understand the other side. But the other side often knows absolutely nothing beyond caricature of what motivates religious people. So we have to, you and me and all the rest of us, keep trying to put the word out there that a lot of people in a secular time don't know. And I think we have to be very mission-driven about that and to be as civil as we can about that, but to do it in the name of all the damage out there.
Well, you and I think, are just two of the people who are going to do that. And, I really do have faith and hope that God is with us. The truth always will out. There are people who are hungry for the truth, whether they know it or not. The final thing I just want to ask you, I was talking originally in the conversation we're having about the establishment of a new religion, that effectively speaking, that's what is happening. I'm not the sort of person who would know what to do about that, but do you think that there's any hope for convincing people in the governing classes that this is what's happening, that it's fundamentally un-American and unconstitutional, and that we need to keep our eyes out for this, even though this secular sexual revolution worldview doesn't purport to be a religion? I don't know how to make that case, but it does seem to me to be clear and that we should try.
I think if people could be persuaded to accept the idea that there are competing religions in America, and one of them is a religion that hitherto hasn't acknowledged itself as one, then it's easier to make the constitutional case that the state has to be impartial toward that religion, too. And that's why I'm trying to change the paradigm out there, because you're right, Eric. The state is throwing its weight on the side of the sexual revolution's faith. And in order to make it harder for the state to do that, we have to convince people that this really is a thriving alternative form of religious faith that the state has no business getting into bed with, as it were.
Well, I'll borrow my friend Terry Mattingly's term, sex rev, and maybe we can just start calling it the sex rev religion, because, of course, that's what it is. Mary Eberstadt, honestly, just a joy finally to speak with you. I have a funny feeling we'll be speaking again soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.
Folks, check out Mary Eberstadt's books. There are many of them. You can check out her article in First Things magazine. You will thank me. God bless you. Keep listening.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.